saves money because you don't have to worry about processors taking 5 to 10%, whatever they're going to take. It's peer-to-peer, so it can't be censored.
Welcome to the show that the fact-checkers warned you about. The one that debunks the mainstream narrative and gives you high-signal, actionable content that helps you navigate the cloud world. It's Bomb Thrower TV with your host, Mark Jeftovic.
So this is like the beginning of my podcast series. I've done a podcast series before, but I've been on a few. I've been on your show, which was great. And now I'm going to launch Bomb Thrower TV, and you're one of my first guests on it. So thank you, Marty Bent, for coming on Bomb Thrower TV.
Well, I'm honored to be here.
Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoyed the TFTC episode that we recorded.
Yeah. And that kind of with all the technical challenges we had to actually get today's up and running, we're doing this through Zoom, which is centralized Chinese malware, and we're hoping for the best. But we're both fans of the decentralized revolution, and we're into decentralized technology. And one of my questions I was going to ask you was about your tech stack that you're using over on TFTC. But given what we just went through, because we were trying to use Jitsi on my end, my server, finally got that working, but a separate issue, we couldn't record it. So here we are on Zoom. Tell me a little bit about your tech stack for how you run TFTC, and where do you think the world is in the adoption curve of decentralized tech and non-cloud solutions, or decentralized cloud, if that's a thing?
Yeah, so we've got many different parts of our business. So we have to separate like the site and the written content hosting. Then we monetize predominantly via Bitcoin for the website, and a lot of the podcast is monetized via Bitcoin as well. And then we have the hosting of the site content, and then the hosting of the podcast content. And I will admit up front, it's not exactly where I want it to be right now, but it is getting there. So we'll just start with the front end stack, which I'm very proud of because I do think it's significantly robust to censorship attacks. Nobody has tried to censor us or anything to date. We had our MailChimp, we had our newsletter on MailChimp for 4.5 years, and they never gave us any problems, even though they were shutting down crypto newsletters left and right. We were a predominantly Bitcoin newsletter, and we never had problems there, but that lingering thought of potential censorship down the line has always been in the back of my mind. And so we've tried to begin distributing our stack as much as possible. So with the newsletter, we moved off of MailChimp and we're using Ghost predominantly, only for our newsletter and website stack. And Ghost is an open source CMS that anybody can use. You can fork off and host it on your own servers. And that's where we're not perfect yet. We don't do that, but we are doing some things unique in where we host our content, which I think does inoculate us a bit, not perfectly, but I'll get to that. So we use Ghost as an open source content management system that we can hack ourselves. And we have hacked Ghost to inject BTC Pay Server, which is an open source Bitcoin payments processor.
Great product.
It's an incredible product.
Yeah.
We actually injected, we fully moved the newsletter over to Ghost this year, but we've been running our site on Ghost since 2019. And right out of the bat, we injected BTC Pay Server into Ghost back then. And so again, since Ghost is open source, you can really hack into their monetization, their layer, which is predominantly run by Stripe, if you get Ghost out of the box. But we found a way to hack into it and inject Bitcoin payments using BTC Pay Server, which is hosted on a node that we run and we control. And so all the invoices that are produced via BTC Pay Server on our site or in the newsletter are produced by hardware that we have access to and technically control, but we don't actually run the servers ourselves. We use a cloud service provider. We were using Amazon for quite a while, but recently we've transitioned all of our hosting from our Ghost content to the BTC Pay server, the Bitcoin full node and the Lightning full node to a company called Noddle Cloud, which is a Bitcoin focused cloud service provider. So while we're not hosting the computers ourselves, just because I'm always on the go, we do have this studio, but I don't think I'm not comfortable with the internet here and the reliability of this physical space to host large servers myself. Would take up a lot of room in here. However, we did make the decision, okay, if we do have to host in the cloud, let's find some like-minded individuals running a cloud service provider that are less likely to censor the way a Google or an Amazon would. And that's Noddle. So if you go to noddle.it, that's their site, and they're a group of Bitcoiners, two Bitcoiners, Laurent and Michel from France, who are building basically a cloud service. They're locking down server space in a geographically distributed way across the world. So they are the ones operating our servers for us. So we have Ghost, we have BTC Pay server, then we host that on using Noddle's cloud, and we trust Noddle more than we would trust Amazon and Google. Ideally, at some point down the line, if this ever becomes a legitimate media business where we have the ability and the funds to invest in our own server infrastructure, we would likely move to that, but we're not there yet. Considering where we are, we just have to use the best options at our fingertips. We think Noddle is that server provider that allows us to do that. And then the podcast hosting is probably the most centralized part of our business. Right now, we syndicate our podcast feed, and we feel comfortable doing this just because of the open source nature of RSS. It's really hard to attack podcasting, but right now we feed our audio and video files via anchor.fm, which is owned by Spotify. However, if we wanted to in the future, BTC Pay server actually just added a podcast server to their stack. And so we could easily begin hosting via our BTC Pay server hosted at Noddle at the snap of a fingertip. Right now, we like Anchor. Even though Spotify is very centralized, for some reason or another, a lot of our listeners listen on Spotify, and using Anchor is the only way we can get the video version of our podcast onto Spotify. And so people like that. We decided, all right, like if you want this, we'll do it via Anchor. But we always had the ability within a day's notice to switch our RSS syndication from another to BTC Pay server if we want to. And then people on Spotify just want to get the video.
That's really cool. I didn't know that BTC Pay server actually added that. I trade emails with Nicholas occasionally. They have their domains with us. So that's how I got familiar with them back in the day. But I'm going to check that out for Bombthrower TV, actually, and just start there and see how that goes. But, it's interesting how there's this perception. And I mean, and you definitely have the right idea. I think that's how we originally started talking, but, and you haven't been attacked yet, but I think if you would have stayed on MailChimp, that probably would have been the first place where you felt it. We call them monkeys for Stalin over here. And, it's basically who they are. And, one time they're all the same as well. Like one time Klaviyo shut down our Access of Easy newsletter just automatically on an algo because one of the issues had the word Bitcoin in it. And it was just like, okay, boom, done. And we had like pretty big spend with them on a monthly basis. But anyway, there's other things out there that people sort of have this perception of being decentralized that actually aren't really decentralized, even though they haven't demonstrated anything. And I see danger points there, like Substack. A lot of my favorite content creators are on Substack, but to me, it's like, that's like a centralized, sweep waiting to happen. And the other thing I noticed for all of the, even Bitcoiners who say they're part of, you know, this is part of the decentralized revolution using Gmail for their email. And that, I mean, I noticed like TFTC is using Proton Mail, which is at least encrypted. And so there you have that. But it's just really, it is hard to get out of that mindset. And it's, and some of it, so much of it is just baked into the plumbing that you don't even know it's there without even really thinking about it, I guess.
Yeah. No, we're happy to be using Proton. And that was a big step for me. I was using Gmail for years. But for Rabbit Hole Recap, the show that I host with Matt O'Dell, Matt has consistently for years basically pointed this out, this daunting task that you just mentioned. It's hard to de-Google yourself, to decentralize yourself. But if you think about it all at once and trying to do it all at once, it's just going to be too overwhelming. And you're never going to take the steps to actually move towards a more decentralized stack. And his advice over years finally dripped into my mind and my thinking, which is like just one step at a time. So yeah, with the newsletter, we moved off MailChimp. Once we had that, I was like, all right, we're on Ghost now. I feel comfortable syndicating this through an open source CMS. What's next? Email for the company. I mean, I still have Gmails for personal accounts and other accounts, but for TFTC, if we're going to practice what we preach and we talk about de-Googling your life, it's like, all right, I need to make a step away from Google for the company email stack at least. And so we started a Proton business account. And I know people even have their qualms with Proton, but I think it's inarguable that it's significantly better than Google when you compare the two. But yeah, it's just taking one step at a time. And we've been trying to do that over the years. And the latest move we made is this server infrastructure transition from Amazon to Nautil as well. So we've done it slowly but surely over the last couple of years.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll add a link to Nautil and the BTC pay server in the show notes. I was going to mention that, my mind just kind of went blank there. There was something you were talking about. Oh, Proton Mail. You said some people have qualms with Proton Mail, but at least with Proton Mail, at least the stated claim is you've got encrypted data at rest. Whereas with Google Gmail, I mean, it's right there in their patents. It's right there in their literature. Like they're data mining your mail. Like it's just part of the whole, I guess, value prop with air quotes around value prop is we data mine your mail. And Proton Mail is like, well, we encrypt your mail. Now you can quibble whether that's true or not true, but I tend to believe I would have more confidence in a Proton Mail than a Gmail any day. So.
Agreed. Yeah, I see the Google ad banners on top of my inbox when I get like my personal account that I've had since I was like 14.
Yeah, which are all targeted to the contents of your email.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I should mention too, for the, you mentioned Substack and is extremely centralized. And I do admire what these guys have done. They have certainly withheld their promise that they're not going to censor people. They're going to allow the content creators that are getting kicked off other platforms to syndicate their content on Substack. However, they've run into the monetization problem where it's not Substack censoring people's content, but Stripe is beginning to censor people's monetization of that content on Substack. So yes, you can syndicate your content there, but if Stripe doesn't like what you're writing about, they can demonetize you on Substack, and there's nothing Substack can do about it. So that's I don't know if you know this, but we're actually, since BTC Pay Server is open source and Ghost is open source, we're actually open sourcing our implementation of the integration of the two. So my developer DJ, not my developer, it's a weird way, the developer DJ who has been building out this integration with me since 2019. We built it for ourselves saying, hey, we want this. I want to get paid directly to the node that I control. I don't want a Stripe in the middle of me, my payments, or I don't want a centralized Bitcoin wallet payment processor like BitPay or Coinbase between me, my Bitcoin payments. Let's do it on BTC Pay Server. So we get it directly. And so we built that out, and it's been a slog 3 years, but we finally gotten it to a point where we feel like it's stable enough to release. So we created a company called Scribsat, We're going to open source the integration. So if anybody wanted to just do it themselves, they have their own Ghost site, they have their own BTC Pay server, and they have the development chops to integrate the two. We are going to open source the code to allow people to do that themselves. But we also have Scribset for the people who are not as technically adept to do that themselves, but do want the benefits of it. And so essentially what Scribset is a centralized entity where we get your Ghost API keys and your BTC Pay API keys, your tokens that get access to create invoices on behalf of your BTC Pay. And we basically connect those two via Scribset. And once you connect them, we provide the code injections to your Ghost site, which help you monetize via BTC Pay server. Exactly. With that, there is a bit of a centralized factor there where Scribset is definitely a centralized entity. You're trusting us not to use your Ghost key. And this is something we're working on, like how to really make it so we can't manipulate content. And then on the BTC Pay server side, we know that you're producing invoices. We can never move money or control any of your money. We just produce invoices via your BTC Pay server keys. So we have access to that too. And but it makes it easy if you want to, if you have Ghost and you have BTC Pay server and you don't want to figure out how to inject the code to monetize via BTC Pay server on Ghost, Scribset will allow you to easily plug in your keys and connect the two automatically. But then there's, with that, if you're okay with that trust model as a content producer, there's some cool things we can do there to begin to compete with Substack, where since we have access to the individual posts and the invoices associated with those posts, we can create a truly meritocratic curation tool via Scribset, where anybody who is connecting their Ghost and BTC Pay server via Scribset, since we have access to that data, we can begin curating content via the flows that are being paid for each individual content. So you still own your Ghost site and host that however you want, and your BTC Pay server, you host that however you want. But since you're connecting the two via Scribset and we have access to that data, we can create a content aggregation system that highlights all the people producing their own Ghost sites. So you sort of create like a Substack-like model, but it's asset-light. We don't host any of the content or the servers. We just have access to connecting the two. And with that, we can create a Substack-like entity that curates different types of content from different individual Ghost sites on the web.
Now that's neat. I'm going to look at that because one of the things that I've been hammering on for years, and I tell as many of my customers at EasyDNS as I can, is you want to start taking Bitcoin payments at your business, right? This is what you want to start doing. That's actually how I accumulated my entire HODL, was just by taking Bitcoin payments since like 2013. And so what we weren't a web host until maybe 5-6 years ago. We rolled out EasyWeb and then now an EasyPress, which is managed WordPress. But the VPSs came out in the last couple of years. And what we're doing now, and we've got a couple beta users on it, is just a commodity VPS, whatever you want underneath, you know, Linux, you know, Debian, CentOS, whatever, and then BTC Pay server on top. And then, so what's happening now with our two test cases is they developed their own API hooks from scratch into these units because they had their own, you know, proprietary setups, like one's a courier company and coming off of, I think, a Windows thing. So it was like, we've got to develop our own hooks, but at least BTC Pay server is open that they can do that. But what you're talking about with Scribset, especially more for content creators, looks pretty interesting, where, you know, especially if you've got the Ghost already set up and you can just start loading your keys in and having access to the ability to be doing that, sounds really empowering.
Yeah. And that the beauty of this model is, like, you still own your content at the end of the day. Like, you're not hosting it on Scribset. We just have access. You see, like, read-only access is what we're trying to get to. To be frank, it's just me and DJ building this out, and we plan on throwing fuel on the fire right now. The way the key structure, like, we do have write access, but we wanted to eliminate that. We're working on on creating that. But yeah, ideally at some point we get read-only access to your Ghost and we connect it with your BTC Pay server. And then you can imagine a world in which many individual content creators are taking advantage of the utility that Scribset provides, which is we'll just connect the two and do the code injection so you don't have to do that manually. And then with access to all that data from hopefully thousands, tens of thousands of different content creators, we can begin to create like a Zero Hedge or a Drudge or a Substack, but you can have a meritocratic curation system that has the best articles rise to the top, and the best articles are those that are having the most sats flows to
right
them.
Yeah. Right, because the key differentiator here is this is all basically user, if you want to call it donation or payment or whatever, people are sending sats to read these articles. It's not an ad driven model.
Exactly. So that's the beauty of Bitcoin in the Lightning Network specifically is, I mean, we built at TFTC, our first model, it's just like a proof of concept. We might change the pricing, but I wanted to prove so Ghost allows us, if you want to read, you can get like a preview of the article. And then below the preview, you get your typical subscribe now. If you want to subscribe and pay a monthly fee or an annual fee, you can do that. Or you can just buy this one article. And I just had this idea in my mind, like I would love to bring back like the 25-cent like gumball machine. Like, could you apply that user experience on the web with content? Like, and so for our paywalled content, it's only 25 cents. You pay us 25 cents worth of Bitcoin over the Lightning Network. You put a quarter in the gumball machine, you get the content. And we've had much success with that. People, and we found that people are willing to pay a quarter, and they much rather do that actually than subscribe monthly or annually, because they don't have to give us their email address. They don't have to give us any payment information. They don't have to worry about like topping up a wallet or anything. They can just consume as they go. If the invoice is paid, we recognize the IP it's paid from, and you can consume that. You can consume that content while you're surfing the web.
And is it a full paywall? Like, if you don't drop the quarter in the gumball machine, you don't read the full article, or is it like voluntary?
It's full paywalled right now, but that's not the only model. You can do voluntary.
Yeah,
you can easily add like a podcasting 2.0 like boost button to the page, which we're working on as well. Yeah, we're experimenting. It's very early on, because that's it's still like the user experience is a wide open canvas. We don't really know at scale what is the best model. Maybe it's the pure paywall where you pay a quarter, or maybe it's giving it out for free and then trusting a minority of your readers to drive the revenues because they like it so much, the super fans, if you will. But that's the beauty of this open source technology, is you can create these different experiences and experiment with them.
So this is really like bleeding edge what you're doing on decentralized content systems. But I mean, am I right? Your base layer, your forte is from the mining side of the business, right?
I got into content before the mining. The content
Okay.
The mining. Right. Yeah, I'm heavily in the mining as well.
I was going to switch tracks there because, you know, there's this perennial objection to Bitcoin mining with the climate hysterics and the global warming thing, and with the recent Ethereum change from proof of work to proof of stake. And, you know, I'll admit, before that happened, I wasn't as vehemently opposed to proof of stake as I am now since it happened, because when it was coming, I was sort of forced to look at what it meant more closely. And then once I came to fully understand why proof of work is better, I used to think like let a thousand flowers bloom, kind of, you know, everyone has their own way of doing things. And then I'm realizing like, no, this is actually the wrong way to do it. Do you want to talk a little bit about why the difference?
Yeah, well, I mean, the main reason, I mean, put most simply to distill the difference between proof of work and proof of stake, I mean, proof of work is truly distributed, whereas proof of stake is simply recreating the system we're trying to move away from. Because, I mean, the nature of proof of work, you have to produce these hashes, and it's a probabilistic hash function where you don't know if you're going to be able to actually produce the hash that is lower than the target. It allows you to add a block to the ledger. So there's a lot of execution risk there, and it's more distributed. It's more connected to the physical world, because to produce those hashes, you need electricity. For the electricity, you need energy. And so there's a lot of execution risk on the front end of producing the hashes that make it so a lot of people are going to fail, and a lot of people are going to come in and out. And so it's more distributed from that perspective. Whereas proof of stake, the consensus is driven by the amount of stake you have in the network. Literally, how much capital can you get to accumulate, using Ethereum as an example, enough Ether to become a validator, and then you just lock up your Ether in the staking mechanism, and you just make money for free because you're validating the chain. You're taking the fees and the inflation on top of that, if it turns out to be inflationary. That's still yet to be determined. But long story short, those who can aggregate the most capital in a proof of stake system are going to control that system at the end of the day. And this is, for Ethereum specifically, this is something Matt and I have been talking about on our rabbit hole recap for 4 years now. Matt has threads going all the way back to 2018, where he perfectly predicted that Ethereum's transition to proof of stake was going to be an extremely centralizing force on that network, because no matter how you slice it, centralized entities, mainly exchanges, were going to be able to provide better yields for their users, because they can have value-added services on top of that. So these big centralized exchanges can provide better value-added services than an individual trying to run a validating node. So if you're in a profit-driven individual and you're looking at the yields you can get from staking with an exchange versus staking individually, the exchange yields are going to be higher, so you're going to stake with them. And then eventually, over time, all the Ether is going to be held by these centralized exchanges that can offer higher yields. And we're only about a month in to the transition from proof of work to proof of stake for Ethereum. And I believe I saw a tweet earlier this week, it's already hit 50% of the validating nodes are OFAC compliant regulated exchanges or entities. And so within a month, that thesis has proven to be true. And it's not only the higher yields that lead to the centralization factor, it's the execution risk on actually running a validator, which isn't easy for your layman. Whereas in Bitcoin's proof of work consensus, that is really driven by very specialized computers, ASICs, it's much easier. You simply plug a computer into the wall or into a generator, whatever it may be, connect it to a pool, and you're automatically running. Whereas with proof of stake, you have to run all these very specific conditions to make sure that you're not being a bad validator, so you don't get slashed and lose all your capital. It's much more risky from an execution perspective. So there's many things. And then, going back to like the whole energy hoopla over proof of work, I just think it's completely misguided. And even stepping away from Bitcoin and Bitcoin's proof of work, just the whole debate around energy in society right now is completely asinine. And we live in a clown world society where people don't actually have any attachment to reality to deny that energy use is a good thing, or to put forth that we should be using less energy is completely idiotic, and it's suicidal as well, as we're seeing everything happening in Europe and even coming here to the United States. And I saw it this morning, they're already fuel rationing in France, which is driven obviously partly by the war that's going on, but this problem started decades ago when the transition away from fossil fuel started.
Yeah, I saw that in France, they had police officers checking cars in gas lineups. And if you have too much fuel in the tank, they're sending you away to speed gas up. I think what people don't get about criticizing Bitcoin's energy usage is that if you consent to that in a moral or philosophical way, it's like, oh yeah, we should do something about Bitcoin's energy usage because it's bad. Let's say you accept that premise. You just put all individual energy usage on the table. Like if Bitcoin energy usage is bad, then what about F1 formula racing? All they do is go around and round and round in circles. What does it accomplish? Nothing. Well, let's get rid of that then. And let's get rid of this TV show because it doesn't. So, I mean, people don't realize that you're actually submitting all energy usage to judgment by whom or on what criteria, no one knows, if you accept that premise. And I think the other thing that you said, that reducing energy usage, I mean, it's kind of anti-human. There is a difference between energy conservation or efficiency and energy usage, I think, right? Because I think the story of human progression has just been denser and denser energy mediums all the way up the scale. And now we're trying to like step that backward to less dense energy systems.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. And I completely agree. There's this conflation that more energy use, this is what the environmentalists will use and the climate hysterics, more energy usage equates with more waste, which isn't true. This is actually the beauty of the Bitcoin mining industry and proof of work is what we're finding, and I've seen it firsthand, these are the operations that I'm involved with, is that Bitcoin mining as a mechanism drives insane efficiencies across the energy sector. And this is purely driven by economics and profit incentive, where Bitcoin miners want to drive their all-in cost of electricity down as low as they can possibly get it. And what you find is the only way to do that is to go find where energy is being wasted or where energy is stranded. And that is what provides you with the lowest cost electricity. And so like my experience personally in the mining industry, I'm focused on the oil and gas sector specifically. My first foray into mining with natural gas was working for Great American Mining, where we were going to upstream oil and gas wells where they were flaring insane amounts of natural gas because the gas didn't have a pipeline to get to market. And since they didn't want to leak methane into the atmosphere, they literally just set it on fire. And so as Bitcoin miners looking for low-cost electricity, we found that that provided us with an opportunity to show up on the upstream oil and gas wells and say, hey, don't flare that gas. Let us run it through generators that will power our miners and we'll mine Bitcoin. We'll stop wasting this natural gas, will actually turn it into economic value in the form of Bitcoin. And since then, my experience in that oil and gas has only expanded where personally, after Great American Mining, I started a company with a friend of mine and we're going up in Appalachia here in the United States and finding stranded natural gas wells that were drilled a decade, two decades ago, where a lot of these wells were part of a shallow oil shale. And basically oil and gas companies would come in, they'd only care about getting the oil out. And so they drill the well and you'd have the oil and the associated gas and they take the oil out and then it would run dry. And they never built pipelines for the gas to get to market because it wasn't economical. Natural gas prices around that time were hovering between like $1 and $2 of MCF. And so it literally didn't make economic sense to invest in the pipeline infrastructure to get that gas to market. So they would just get the oil out and then cap the gas and leave it there. And so in Appalachia and many other parts of the country, there's these stranded natural gas wells that are a product of this type of oil extraction. They're just sitting there and some of them are leaking methane and all of them are being wasted where you have the ability to do something with that gas. You can't get it through a pipeline and the best thing you can do with it is mine Bitcoin. So that's the beauty of distributed proof of work. It doesn't matter where you are. You just have to get the generators to produce electricity to the source and you can monetize it right on site. And so we're doing that as well. And this is helping prevent methane leak. And more importantly, I think, and just purely driven by economics, we're getting value out of this strand of gas. And that's, and this is only the tip of the iceberg. That's off-grid operations. And then when you talk about on-grid operations, it's like if you have a well-built-out grid system, these grids only are designed to service peak demand. And so you build a grid big enough to produce electricity and deliver electricity in the middle of the summer, in the middle of the winter, when it's hottest and coldest, when people are running their air conditioners and heaters. But outside of those peak demand periods, you're still producing the same amount of electricity. And so a significant amount of that is being wasted. And so Bitcoin miners have the ability to come in during those off-peak demand times, which make up most of the year, to actually give value to those utility providers by providing a revenue stream in the form of Bitcoin mining. And so all this gets back to the fact of what we're saying, like, yes, you don't want to just create energy to create energy. You want to make sure you're being as efficient as possible. And in my life, I've never come across a better mechanism to be as energy efficient as possible than Bitcoin mining.
Right. I have a neighbor a few doors over in this, and he came out of the hydro business in, I think, North America, not just Ontario, but we were at like a cocktail party one night in the neighborhood, and he was telling me about, you know, there's tons of energy in the world. We just can't get it to where it needs to be. And the one story he told me, which sounded urban legendish, and I kind of pressed him on it. And he's like, no, this is really, Niagara Falls pushes water back up the falls to vaporize excess energy production. Like they have to, like, to your
balance point, out their load. Yeah.
To balance out the load when it's off peak, it's like, we can't send this electricity anywhere. So we'll just pump water back up Niagara Falls to just use the energy up.
Yeah.
Man, you got to put some Bitcoin miners in there.
Exactly. So that's like, that's a loss right there, yeah. Right? Like you're literally spending money to build infrastructure to carry the water back up just so you can use that electricity. Where imagine if you didn't have to do that, and you can actually, instead of having an expense on your business, you can turn that into a positive revenue stream.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, it's this energy cost in my mind that actually gives Bitcoin its value. Like this whole backed by nothing thing, I just find is only from people who haven't even done like even the most rudimentary dive into this, because I think for anything to have value, there has to be an economic trade-off involved in doing it. And it's one of the reasons why the world is in the state it's in today, is because there's no economic trade-off to creating fiat money, right? If a central banker can press a button and create $30 trillion, there's no economic trade-off in doing it other than the vacuum it creates through Cantillon effect, when it sort of like makes all the Wall Street guys and private equity rich, and then it drifts out into the outer circles and makes everybody else poorer because their cost of living goes up. But if there was an actual economic cost to generating those currency units, that's what would give them an underlying base value that someone has to say, okay, I would rather have a Bitcoin right now, or I would rather have a car. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree, but I would argue it's not the only, because that's a lot of Bitcoiners historically have made the misconception that like Bitcoin mining is this battery, where it's like, no, we're using energy, and energy is a raw input into securing the network. And the fact that it has security definitely drives value to the network, but it's not the only value driver.
It's not just Bitcoin is not just stored energy, then, is what you're saying.
No, because you have to expend the energy to create the hashes,
right,
at every second of every day. But it is certainly a good base, but the value is not only driven by the energy, it's driven by the utility of the network, as well as a peer-to-peer distributed cash system and settlement network, where it literally allowed, like going back to the newsletter and the paywall, like there's no other network, payments network outside of Bitcoin and the Lightning Network, that stack that can allow individuals to pay 25 cents for a piece of content immediately on the web. Like, that inherent utility, that use case has a lot of value. And it saves money because you don't have to worry about payment processors taking 5 to 10%, whatever they're going to take. It's peer-to-peer, so you can't be censored. And so those attributes compound the value that is also sitting on top of the base layer of proof of work, driven by energy usage.
You know, micropayments have been the holy grail of the internet since, you know, the early 90s. And that's what you're talking about, basically, especially with Lightning.
Yes. Yeah. And the podcast, I wouldn't even consider the 25 cents a micropayment, with the newsletter, 25 cents is a micropayment. But with the podcast, and we haven't even broached this yet, but that's the other thing with podcasting 2.0, which I know you're well aware of, has come to market. And this is an iteration on the original vision of podcasting created by Adam Curry. And he is also not only heavily involved, he founded Podcasting 2.0, which is the next iteration of podcasting in his mind. And what that allows individuals like myself to do is, when I syndicate my podcast out via RSS feed, Podcasting 2.0, essentially what they've done, the biggest thing they've done, is added what's called a value block to the RSS feed, which allows me to put my Lightning Network public address in my RSS feed. So when I send the audio files to my podcast out, these podcasting apps don't only have to pick up the file and the information on the file, now they can pick up my Lightning address too. So any individual who's listening to TFTC or Rabbit Hole Recap via a podcasting app that is podcasting 2.0 compatible, and it's podcasting 2.0 compatible because it has a Lightning wallet within the app, anybody listening via these apps can stream myself, Matt, our producers, our developers, Satoshis, immediately and in real time, and they get to set the price. And so the newsletter example was 25 cents for a newsletter article. And right now that's about, I want to say 1,200 Satoshis, maybe 1,250 Satoshis. But with podcasting 2.0, like, I can show you my phone right now. We probably have people streaming us like one sat at a time, which is a fraction of a penny. And again, going back to the inherent utility that Bitcoin provides, in Lightning specifically, we're sitting here right now and you can see that.
Right. It's a little blurry, but I do see stuff there.
Yeah. But yeah, so you're saying like it's 157 right now, and I just got a payment. I just received 2 sats, which is a fraction of a penny. You can't do that over Visa. You can't do that over MasterCard. And again, that's going, so this wallet I just showed you is connected to the full node that I control. And so it's going directly from my listeners to my wallet. I don't have to go ask Bank of America or Stripe or Visa or MasterCard or PayPal to release those funds to me.
Yeah. I mean, I just put an article out today about this whole PayPal thing, but I was looking for, and then a reader wrote me and he said, okay, cause you know what we're talking about, PayPal's, you know, aborted.
2,500.
Yeah. So a reader emailed me and said, you know, read your article and, you know, what would you recommend as an alternative? You know, like GabPay announced something. I said, okay, all of those things, you have the same problem. Whenever you have to trust another intermediary, you have the same problem because the rules can change with those intermediaries, or their whims can change, and they can, you know, they may say they're not going to censor you today, but that may change tomorrow. And so the only true solution to it is to switch the protocol, like switch the structure of the underlying system, so no one can do that to you. And that's exactly where the trustless thing comes from. Sorry, I was looking for a diagram. We were talking about this whole micropayment thing. You introduced me to Jared from Get Mash.
From Mash.
And I just kind of had this brainwave after I talked about it where I thought, you know, you could use existing email, right? And this could even work on Twitter DMs, I suppose, because I'm finally at the point where I'm getting overwhelmed with Twitter DM spam now. Like this is out of control. It's crazy. But you could actually set up a mail server so that if you don't know me and you're not in my contact list and you want to get in touch with me, I could set a price and say it costs you one sat to get through my filter, right? And until that, the email server is just going to soft bounce it all and just send it all back to you. But until, you know, you send one sat or 10 sats or whatever, you get through. And then if I accept the message and say, okay, I grant permission to this person to be able to email me, then you're in my contact list. And then my mail server is just going to whitelist your mail. And these are the kinds of, like, when I think about this and Lightning, it can completely change the nature of the game entirely. It can save these old protocols from all this huge level of noise that's underneath all of them.
Yeah. I'm sure you just saw me on my laptop. I wasn't distracted. I was looking.
No, I saw that. Yeah.
This product was built already. Go to vida.page, VIDA.page. Lyle Pratt is actually a developer here in Austin. And he's a big Bitcoin and Lightning advocate. He has transitioned out of the telecommunications industry to focus on building Vida.page and Vida. And this is exactly what you're describing. So, like, I have a Vida profile and I have a similar problem where if I don't want to answer DMs, I can just push people to Vida and I can see their messages. And if I accept their message, they pay me sats right away.
This is a Twitter thing.
No, it's agnostic. You can do it with phone calls, you can do it with text, but
interesting. I'm going to look at that. I'll put that in the show notes too.
Yeah, you can do it with gaming. That's the beauty of these open protocols, Bitcoin and Lightning. Like, you can inject it into everything.
So this is interesting. It comes back to when I think when I was on the tail end of my conversation with you, when I was on your rip, and I sort of was thinking out loud, like, what happens in the future if hyper Bitcoinization actually takes place? Wouldn't that grind? I used to worry that would grind money velocity to a halt because no one would want to spend their Bitcoin. But with Lightning, you see this almost, it's almost like a lubricant or a fluid that sort of floats on top of all these protocols, and the amount involved is so small on an individual transaction level, but you get so much signal in exchange for the small amount of sats that you would actually see a lot of the money velocity, I think, diffuse down to those ultra small Lightning payments just flitting around that are just sending. They're almost like headers that says the message or the payload to follow is actual signal, not noise. I mean, That's almost the use case of Lightning at that point.
Yeah, if you're going to send it, you're literally sending value and messages attached to it. So you better hope the message is valuable. And so as somebody's receiving that message, you can go with the intention, like, oh, this is probably valuable. Somebody's paying sats.
Yeah.
To get it to me.
Yeah. I'm switching tracks again. You had Whitney Webb on your show a bunch of times, right? Mm-hmm.
Whitney's a good friend.
Yeah, she's great. I haven't met her, but I am doing the audiobook for the One Nation Under Blackmail. So I'm looking forward to listening to that. But so I'm going to get her on at some point. But when you talk with her, and we hit on it briefly when we last talked to, it used to be like, I used to sort of really subscribe to the, it's not conspiracy, it's incompetence, right? These people are just, it's just clown world. It's really clown world run riot. I still believe that to a certain extent, but when you hear someone like Whitney just lay out all the research that she's been doing on this, and, you know, we won't talk for Whitney, but I want to bring it back because you mentioned one thing in there. At least once you said it's demonic. And I really, that kind of perked up my ears. And I thought, okay, do you mean literally demonic or do you mean figuratively demonic? I wanted to ask if you've ever heard of a guy named Rudolf Steiner, he was a German and he died in like 1924. But I'll just preface it with this. Rudolf Steiner was, he was a spiritualist and he was a German. He invented the Waldorf schools. I don't know if you're familiar with those, but he created those and biodynamic farming and stuff like that. And he talked about an age that was coming that he said would happen near the end of the century. That would be like the rise of what he called Eremon. And what he said out of that, all that was that humanity would sort of lose sight of its own soul and become very materialistic and very, very reductionist and very obsessed with the material. And it sort of fits a lot of what we see happening today in this obsession with the metaverse and the idea that we can upload our brains into a cloud. And so I just wanted to, I mean, that's sort of the basis under what I've been aware of that made my senses perk up to when you called it demonic, to sort of say, well, what exactly do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's hard. So I believe in good and evil. I believe that there's good. I believe that there's evil. Whether or not people are literally possessed by demonic spiritual beings and are being driven to do things by those spirits or interdimensional beings, as Alex Jones would describe them, I don't know. I do know, again, just distilling it to good versus evil, there does seem to be a significant amount of evil that is pervasive throughout our culture that needs to be called out. And demonic as a descriptor is very potent and makes people think, and obviously made you think. And I wouldn't, with that being said, like I will not say for certain one way or the other whether these people are actually possessed by spiritual beings or not. But I think you can just move past that and just look out at the world objectively and recognize that there is objective evil that has pervaded society. How would one describe evil? It could be described in many ways. I think simplest way is just detaching people from reality, from truth. And a lot of what drives our culture these days, it really got me thinking about this was the music industry. It was like 5 or 6 years ago. My wife and I, we had her Jeep Liberty that she had from high school, and it didn't have an aux cord or Bluetooth. And so I had to listen to the radio and was listening to like the Top Rat Hits radio in New York City. And I was driving a lot at that time. And like the one song that was like the top hit at the time was called Mask Off by Future. And the song, like literally the refrain of the song is like Percocets, Percocets. It's just like this demonic drumming of like trying to, it seemed to me that like it was just trying to incept this idea that people should be taking Percocets into the minds of the masses listening to the music. And it was just that medium, like radio, where any child, teenager, young person, adult could tune in and just have this droning Percocets, 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 always seemed weird to me, demonic, evil, that is what was being pushed on the mainstream. And that's only one example. I mean, we can get into the whole COVID lockdowns, vaccine rollout, what's going on with the monetary system, how it is objectively, you mentioned the canteen effect, like it is objectively unfair and evil, and it benefits a very select few over the masses who make up billions on this planet. And yeah, like everywhere in society, whether it be music, with the authorities, what they did with the lockdowns, the monetary system, how politics works these days, it just all seems, again, getting back to detachment from reality, all it seems detached from reality. And like with the Percocet examples, like that should not, that's in reality, that's not what people should be striving to do. That's not what should be vaunted and held up is the culture of taking opioids in the monetary system. You can just print monetary units out of thin air that have no attachment to reality. That's very far away from truth. And then politics in the COVID lockdowns, driven by those politics, like these select few people literally could not make good decisions because they don't have access to the granular information necessary to make actually educated decisions about what happened then. So that's another detachment from reality. And so, yeah, I mean, I think we do live in a very materialistic, detached world that has a lot of evil in it. And that's, I don't know if it's why I decided to get into Bitcoin and focus. And it actually is why, because I was radicalized in high school. I was a senior in high school in the fall of 2008 when the financial system was going to shit. Just so happened to be taking an elective economics class, and our teacher, I think it was like a hardcore libertarian. I went to an all boys school, and he was like, "Gentlemen, like, this is not good. What's happening right now? It's not just. It's not right." And so we actually went and like dug through the TARP bill and really got into the nature of bailouts. And at 17 years old, I realized with the financial system and the monetary system specifically that something was really off, that it wasn't fair. And so I went into college with like a know your enemy mentality and studied economics to better understand that system. And then when I found Bitcoin, it just really clicked with me, like, oh, this is the solution to this form of evil. And that's why I've dedicated my life to it over the last decade, is because I do think, again, humans are detached from reality right now, which is driving a lot of evil, and we need to get back to bring good into the world, and Bitcoin is a great avenue through which to do that.
It's interesting that it was a libertarian teacher in your school that, you know, kind of radicalized you, because there probably aren't that many libertarian teachers left in the school system anymore.
Well, luckily I went to a private school, so
yeah,
we paid for the good education.
Yeah. Well, we send our daughter to a private school, and it's not as bad as the public schools, but so she's taking economics now, and we're at parent teacher night the other night, and she said, "Oh, Dad, meet my economics teacher." And I'm meeting her economics teacher, and I'm saying, yeah, I'm just trying not to get going. Like, just don't get me started. Don't get me started on stuff. She's like, "Well, Dad, tell them about the stuff you tell me about." And I'm like, "Well, you know, Austrian school economics and von Mises and Hayek." And then her teacher says to me, "Are you from Austria?"
Oh, no.
I'm like, "Oh my God." And, you know, I'm like, okay. But I was radicalized by a libertarian, the guy who actually who was the first president of the Canadian Libertarian Party, Zig Peta. And I still talk to him today all the time. And so I got my first job out of college working on his COBOL like computer in his courier company. And he was the one who got me into all of that stuff. And so, like, everyone, a lot of people in this space seem to have been radicalized by a libertarian ahead of them. And it just they kind of go together.
I mean, it's, what do you call it, libertarianism or Austrian? I like to lean on Austrian, like, economic theory. I mean, I think that's a problem with, like, the evil in the world. It's just driven by the fact that we have central planners trying to micromanage a global economy, a society. Just what Austrian economics teaches you is that it's just not tenable. It's going to collapse in of itself, because if you believe in information theory, like, you cannot centrally plan a global economy, or you can even deduce it to the US economy. It cannot be centrally planned, because it's not going to work. The people centrally planning the economy don't have access to all the information or the best information. And most importantly, even if they did have the information, they wouldn't be the best deciders what to do with that information. The people on the ground with the problems with the information are the best to solve those problems. And so, just using a simple complex system heuristic of complex systems are inherently grassroots and emergent, the whole society that we've erected today, whether it be in the political realm, the monetary realm, the financial realm, is completely top down. And all these realms are supposed to be emergent complex systems, and they just don't have the ability to thrive as those types of systems with all the central planning in every different area of our life.
Yeah, I think central planning only has one capability, and that's to to exacerbate all solutions they're trying to solve. Like that's the one thing they can do. And you know, our superpower as humans is really adaptability. Like these systems emerge and then we just figure out ways to deal with whatever is happening.
So. Yeah. And you can only adapt if you are able to use the information, your local information, and then use that to change your local surroundings. And with central planning, you don't even have the ability to do that.
I think that's what I won't keep you much longer, but I think that's what really, like, if I wasn't already radicalized before COVID, it's what really did me in during COVID. Was I just felt so let down by the policymakers and the media, right? Where it's like, I can't even trust the media. I can't base a decision on anything that's coming at me through so-called mainstream channels. I can't use any of that information. I'm not saying I know better than the experts or that I'm a genius. All I'm saying is I have to make all of my decisions in a tunnel, like with blinders on. And that felt really like isolating. And it's like, okay, I've been profoundly let down by this system that I pay these tax dollars to. And they're teaching my kid nonsense in school. And I mean, she's been radicalized at home. So I'm not worried about her too much, but just in general. And so this idea that what saved me finally, because I could have really sank into despondency, was just this idea of like, okay, we have to build the system that we want. You can't reform that system. That system already has its inertia. It's on a logic path of its own, and it's not going to change. There really isn't any changing it. So this is why, you know, I was into Bitcoin before, but I really doubled down on it since I started the Crypto Capitalist and Bomb Thrower Media and pushing EasyDNS more into the space. It's like, you got to just build the world you want, because the world we don't want is in charge right now. And there's not a lot we can do about it, but at least they can't control reality, even though they think they can. So at least over here where we're like seeking out better information signals, we can at least deal with the consequences of reality being ignored with better information and better community networks and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And the tools we have at our fingertips are the most potent tools that humans have ever had access to, particularly open source software. We can build really fast. I mean, it's pretty insane.
Yeah.
How quickly Bitcoin has gotten to the state it's in today, even though all the talking heads and the financial media will say it's a Ponzi and it doesn't work. I mean, if you're in the space, I'm using Podcasting 2.0, I'm injecting it into my newsletter, it works, and it's only getting better, and it's getting better faster as more and more people recognize the utility and the ability to build on it, despite the naysayers in the media. And no, that's the beauty. I mean, it's the famous Buckminster Fuller quote, like, you're not going to change an existing system by changing it from within. You have to build a completely new system external to that system. And then that's how you get out of it. And that's exactly what we're doing with Bitcoin and all these other tangential distributed projects.
Yeah. Well, Marty, this has been great. I really appreciate you coming on.
I'm honored to be one of your first guests.
Yeah. Thank you. And do you want to just lay out your coordinates for people who want to follow your podcast and your newsletter and stuff like that?
Yeah. So I've got two podcasts. You can search TFTC for the interview series. And then I do Rabbit Hole Recap, which is a weekly news show with my co-host, Matt Odell, where we go over the topics of the week in Bitcoin and privacy, distributed systems, macroeconomics. We cover a wide range of topics. And then the website, if you want to sign up for the newsletter, is tftc.io. And then I hang out on Twitter a lot at Marty Bent.
Cool. Yeah, that's how we met on Twitter. Couldn't believe it was really you at first, because so many fake Twitter profiles are out there. But yeah.
How's your trade going, sir?
All right. Okay. Thanks, Marty. Great to talk to you again.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
Thank you.